What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Welcome to Ethnically Ambiguous, a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Hello.
Hi, Shireen.
Hi, Anna. This is Ethnically Ambiguous. Tell us about our episode today. What a ride.
Oh my gosh. Woo! We have a great episode for you today. That was a little bit of a meme for you right off the bat. We have a great episode. We have a journalist, food writer, podcaster. I mean, just interesting person in general on the show today. Okay. Their name is Ahmed Ali Akbar. Welcome.
He's here too.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
James Beard Award winner, may I say?
Still doesn't feel real.
I know. You're so brown. Me? I couldn't have. I? No. All right. Well, it's going to be a great episode. So stay tuned.
Who are we? Where did we come from? Who do we become? What is it to be? What to be is it? Where are we? Who are my parents? Where are my pants? Why were we born? We are Ethnically Ambiguous.
Hi, and welcome. I'm Shireen, and this is Ethnically Ambiguous.
Hi, I'm Anna, and this is Shireen, and this is Ethnically Ambiguous. Great times. We have a great show today. Mm-hmm. I'm excited to talk to our guest today. Yes, we have a guest.
He is very accomplished.
Very accomplished.
Has a Wikipedia page.
Oh, I didn't even know they had a Wikipedia page.
Yeah. Oh, I'm going to get all into the searching I did. But before, I mean, we should just bring him on because I sound like a creep otherwise. But his name is Ahmed Ali Akbar, and he is a podcaster, a journalist, and I'm really curious about all the work he's done.
Well, podcaster, and most importantly, a James Beard. Have you heard of it?
Bum, bum, bum.
That's true.
Okay. They got an award from the James Beard. Do you know how prestigious that is? It's a pretty big deal. We've actually only ever had a James Beard semifinalist on here.
We did?
Oh, actually, no, that's not true. Yara won one. My bad. Sorry, Yara. Ooh. Anyway, they got one because they're out here. They understand what's going on with mangoes. Okay, well, we'll get into it.
Okay. Yes, but welcome to the show.
Can I say hi now? Can I jump in now? Is
that my last? Yes, please. Welcome to the show.
I don't know.
The pause was for like sort of like, you know, like I was trying to create like an extreme energy of intensity.
As a freelance journalist, it's hard to ever feel very accomplished. So thank you for picking me up while I'm sitting here, you know, in my little podcast studio in my own house.
I was like looking you up, being like, damn.
The Wikipedia page is new, by the way. I'm not like somebody who's perpetually Googling myself or anything, but I did happened to find out that that happened. It was after the James Beard Awards. Before that.
Well, of course.
I mean, it's incredible. I do want to just disclaimer to the audience, if you happen to hear noise in the background, it is from my side. I apologize, whatever. But when I did Google you the first time, well, just like the time I Googled you, just your name, a Pakistani yes. actor came up.
I was going to say, that's the other thing.
At first, I was like, wait a minute, I didn't, like, is he acts too? And I was looking at all these things and I was like, this has to be the wrong guy, obviously. And then like 2 minutes later, I just put journalist after your name and then all your stuff popped up. But you also had a Wikipedia page with this as well as this Pakistani actor. So y'all are on equal levels as far as I'm concerned.
I get confused for him a lot now.
If I won a James Beard Award, I would introduce myself as James Beard Award winner Anna Jose. Like I wouldn't even like be like, I'm not accomplished. I'd be like, you should try and catch up to me. Because I don't know if you guys know, but I mean, I literally just said it. It's a prestigious award to win. So I would, you should just start introducing yourself like that.
I will say it was fun to, you know, my family, their number one thing about me, they always go, we love your blog. I don't have a blog. I don't know what they're talking about. But my family in Pakistan, they're always like, we love your blog. I'm like, okay,
well,
whatever.
Wikipedia, it says you started a blog.
But that was a long time ago. It hasn't been active since like maybe like 2015, 16. So it was nice to be like, you know, the James Beard Awards are like the Oscars of the food world.
Yeah, it is.
So like,
it really
you know, that, I could say that. And I did feel good about being able to explain my work to my family like that.
Yeah. It makes it more tangible, I think, when people don't understand like the intricacies of like your field. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, oh, you
yeah.
won an award. Good.
Yeah.
And like the award.
The award, yes.
The award when it comes to anything nutritious food.
Mm-hmm. But I want to talk about how you actually ended up winning that award. And to do sure. that, I want to go back in time. And I want to know where you grew up, where you were born.
Sure. Yeah, I was born in Michigan, a town called Saginaw. It's like a rusted corpse of...
Yeah, I've heard the song.
GM. Yeah, there's that. There's a couple of songs that bring up Saginaw. But it's like an ex, you know, Motor City kind of thing. It's like a Detroit-style thing where like all these people came as factory workers to that area. So my parents came because they were in the medical profession and those factory workers their bodies were destroyed by that work. So a lot of immigrant doctors started moving there and that's now the biggest industry there, the medical industry. So I was born and raised in that little part of Michigan.
Nice.
And basically spent my whole childhood there. Not like a super small town, but you know, not a big one either. It's like 50 to 100,000 people.
Yeah. Where did your parents immigrate from?
So my parents are both from Pakistan. They're both, you know, children of refugees from partition. So, you know, they were in East Punjab and they, you know, my grandparents like left their home in 1947 and never went back and like settled in Pakistan. My parents were born there. This is like a joke about my dad that I make sometimes is that when I ask him a question, he goes, well, it all starts with British colonialism.
Most things do.
Which is somewhat true.
Most things do. I don't think that's a joke.
Well, I'll be like, what did you have for lunch today? And he'll be like, well, it all starts with British colonialism.
I mean, but even that's not
Yeah, it's all true.
That is why I'm drinking chai.
Because it all starts with British colonialism.
Yeah, so they met in Pakistan. They met in college. They had a love marriage and they got married and they moved to America the night after they got married. And I was born like 10, 12 years later.
Wow, that's fast.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they knew each other. They were like best friends.
No, fast to move here. I mean, like,
oh yeah,
just like immediately be like, okay, this is our life. Let's go.
As I understand it, there was some deadline with the immigration's like policy in the U.S. And I think my mom was ready first, and my dad had to graduate another year. So they both were rushing to hit this deadline and like both go at the same time. They were lucky that they made this like deadline where they could both come. And yeah, they were like, we're gonna go back, but they never did. I spent like a year when I was like 1 year old after my grandparents passed away. We lived in Pakistan. Like my first language was actually Urdu because we were in Pakistan then. But then we came right back and settled into Saginaw for the rest of our lives, basically.
What was it like growing up in Michigan for you?
It was hard. I like have a lot of appreciation for where I came from. It was like, it was relatively diverse. It was like taught me a lot of values, but like the racial and cultural discourse was very difficult. It was very, very difficult to slot into.
Yeah.
And it's just like a highly segregated place. There's like a white side of town and a black side of town, and like white people have horrible things to say about the black side of town, and they're so dehumanizing about, you know, this majority of, you know, like this large population of, you know, people of color living there. And so, you know, it was very confusing for me because I didn't understand like how they could get away with saying such hateful things about people that they were you know, so close to physically, like a lot of immigrants like tend to do, a lot of, you know, South Asian immigrants, you know, we like lived on the closer to the whiter side of town and were surrounded by people who, yeah, said a lot of messed up things. Right. So yeah, it was challenging. It was challenging, but it made me who I am. And I feel a lot of pride in being a Michigander. I'm wearing like a Carhartt beanie because that's a Michigan.
Oh, I didn't know it was a Michigan corporation. Company. That's cool.
It's Dearborn, 1880s. Wow. It's that whole, you know, manufacturing thing. Obviously, I have no connection to manufacturing besides the fact that people that I grew up with were working in those, you know, environments and had a lot of pride of in that. But yeah, Michigan, I wish it was mm-hmm. like a place I could settle in, but unfortunately, it's very hard to imagine me mm-hmm. moving back.
Wait,
there.
So where are you?
Yeah, where are you living
right now?
I'm in Chicago. Nice. I just moved to Chicago from New York. I was in New York for 8 years mm-hmm. working in media, and my partner got a job over here, and I work from home, and I never leave the house.
Works out.
So it's like, yeah, sure, yeah. Let's go to Chicago, and it's closer to family.
Yeah, I mean,
it's a nice little compromise.
Yeah, we went to Chicago together.
I really enjoy Chicago. I think it's such a great city and it's so fun and there's so much culture, you know. I mean, of course, it has its own issues with segregation, but like even I love the downtown mm-hmm. area. Like it's hard to find like a lovely downtown that's like an actual mm-hmm. city.
Yeah, it always surprises me. Yeah, I like Chicago too. I think it's one of the, it's a challenging city in the Midwest because it's a rare place where like you have to walk places, but it's also the weather's terrible.
God, it's so cold.
So that's probably the thing that makes it so hard. Like in Michigan, like the weather is awful, but you just go from parking mm-hmm. lot to parking lot and it's fine. You know, you don't have to like wait for a bus.
Well, that's right.
Because there are no buses because there's no public services.
I noticed that about Minneapolis when I was there. It's like everything is underground or above ground, like tunnels. Like they keep you off the streets. And also actually Chicago downtown does have that like underground tunnel that you can like walk through. It's like an underground world. It's like shopping malls and food. And need more of that.
I'm a fan. I think the food here is great. As a food person, I am very impressed by the food here, having not explored it much.
Yeah.
It's a great little historical.
One of those top U.S. cities, you know, it's up there. Yeah. And the first time I was there, I was with Anna over here, and it was a fun little exploration that we did together. Yeah. It's a nice town.
Yeah, what was that restaurant we went to? That was so my God. Good. We went to a really good restaurant by recommendation of a family member of mine.
I don't know, but it was incredible. Chicago, good food.
You know what? I'll look it up. We'll let you know.
Yeah, I'll go.
Because I think should go. Yeah. It was really good.
Yeah, I'm new. I don't know stuff here very much. I haven't eaten that much.
I haven't eaten that much. Are you okay?
Eaten out much. Sorry.
No worries.
Oh my God. Are you doing okay?
It's cold out here. Okay, it's tough. I'm not leaving this house. I'm scavenging on the rats in my building.
I have a question for you. What part of Chicago do you live in?
I live in an area called Pilsen, which is a historically Mexican neighborhood.
Don't know it, but I'm interested.
Yeah, it's about 10-15 minutes from downtown. It's pretty close, honestly. It's really nicely located centrally.
Pilsen. Nice.
Yeah. And like you said, very segregated.
So yeah. I mean, I kind of didn't realize
very surprised.
That. I mean, obviously it is, but like sometimes it's just more blatant than others. I don't know. You forget that.
Yeah.
But I'm going to go back to Michigan for a moment in your youth. What was it like for you like in high school when you were like imagining what you wanted to do? Like, did you have an idea of what you were interested in? What were you passionate about? What was the vibe?
So, you know, I had two older sisters who had kind of thrown off the professional dream mm-hmm. that many immigrant parents have for their kids. Well, sorry, not the professional dream, the doctor dream, more specifically.
Doctor, engineer, lawyer?
So my sisters both rejected the doctor dream. They tried and they mm-hmm. didn't really want to do it. Not that they were bad at science, but they just, it was like, my parents were very involved in activism and writing and stuff. So they became lawyers, but they were like civil rights lawyers. You know, they weren't like doing like, they did the professional thing, but it wasn't in order to do the things that most people associate with that. You know, they did like civil rights stuff, like my sister does stuff on family defense. And then I'm like, come along like 10 years later and I'm like, okay, I'll try this doctor thing again. I didn't really, same thing. I just wasn't passionate because my mom was like an amazing speaker, an amazing writer. You know, people paid attention to her when she came into a room, and not because she was a doctor. It was because she was like a powerful woman who had strong opinions and cared about like justice and like making the world a better place. So like that inspired me. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do at first, but I went to grad school. And at first I was like doing like a little bit of science, but then I just was studying religion because that was a big interest in our family. It was like the study of Islam. And like, you know, my parents had a very particularly open-minded view of Islam that they passed on to me. That was like traditional, but also quite flexible.
Nice.
Like I learned a lot of traditional things, but I learned flexible that it didn't have to be that way. And like you wanted to know the tradition, but also like be able to adapt it in ways that made sense to you.
Yeah.
So I studied religion. I went to grad school. I got a degree in Islamic studies, and grad school was awful. It was like interesting, but it just like career-wise, I was like, people want to do this for the rest of their life. This is, you have to like suck up to an advisor who like hates you and just doesn't care about you at all. So then I just started blogging, and I like ended up in media kind of by happenstance, and turned out to be a good like combo of all those things that my mom did that I liked, which was like writing and like sharing ideas and stuff.
And your blog was called Rad Brown Dads. That's what it was called. Why?
That's right. That was the blog I started in grad school. It was a bunch of, I was like, I guess I'm into fashion somewhat. Like, I like clothes and what they tell about people. So I was very interested in how these immigrant dads, like, they'd be in, like, Pakistan, and they'd be wearing, like, the deepest V-cut shirt you could ever see. Like, the massive lapels, the tight bell-bottoms. And they come to America, and they just, like, polos. Start wearing, like, you know, like, sweatpants and polos. But I was just like, okay, like...
hoodies.
Yeah, hoodies or whatever, you know, like... You know, my dad's classic outfit is a track pants and a blazer, like... but, like, you look at him, and he was so stylish. I was like, what happened to all that? So I just started kind of collecting them as, like, sort of, like, a bit of history. Like, it was all, like, 70s, 80s pictures of immigrant parents. Typically, when they were abroad before they had kids, but sometimes not. And it just kind of took off for a bit. Like, it developed a bit of an audience. It's kind of like Brown History before Brown History was Brown History, if you're familiar with that Instagram. But with much less rigorous, like, I wasn't actually doing any history. I was just like, there were some interesting moments there. Like, somebody sent in a photo of their grandfather swimming in the Lahore Canal, which is something that the British dug into Lahore and is very not something you would swim in now. But like, he's like an Andre the Giant type swimsuit where it's like, you know, like, the singlet, you know?
Yeah.
It's just such a great photo. And it's like, wow, I didn't even know people swam in the Lahore Canal ever, much less like just a bunch of young guys in the, I think it was like the 40s or 50s or something. So, so it was just kind of like a kind of bit of community historian work on the side, I guess.
That's cool. I have some great photos I can submit to that.
Yeah. I should probably bring it back, but you know, cool. I don't know. At the same time, and it's my Twitter account now. That's why my Twitter account is Rad Brown Dads, because I feel like it was the first time I developed an audience. Like, I always wanted an audience, and I never had one until I started that blog. So that became my Twitter account as a, you know, and then I was like, one day I'll become a dad and this will make sense. Because people would often ask me how my kids were. Like, when I was like 25, 26, I didn't have kids. And I'd be like, I don't have kids, just my blog name. And now I have a 14-month-old daughter, and I can be like, let's come back around. I'm a dad now. I'm a Rad Brown Dad.
Rad Brown Dad.
Rad Brown Dad.
Pretty cool.
But also, like, in 2014, I feel like the brown identity was, like, in the mix as a possibility alongside, like, people of color. It was like, you know, could it be, like, a thing that people could say to, like, build unity or whatever? But, you know, I think it's a little dated now. I mean, I do think, like, you could call me brown, I guess, but it's not like a
political, it is a little dated. You're right.
Term that I really identify with now. It's a little dated.
It was kind of really trendy for a good while. Like, just the word brown in general, I think it was, like, really just in part of the culture for a long time. But I do think it's, like, the trend is kind of weaning out.
I mean, it's a little dated as a Twitter account, too, but I don't mind because it's like, you know, you get old and you get dated. That's fine. It's like, I'm a dad now. I can be dated. I don't have to
I mean, I think keeping the original name is good, though, because I feel like something starting a long time ago gives it so much, like, not institutional, but, like, roots. It has value and, like, in time and in culture and all that stuff. It's because you've been there, you know?
Yeah. When Hasan Minhaj was doing Patriot Act, he made a reference to it on one of his questions. I was like, whoa, Hasan Minhaj was reading the blog. Yeah, he told a story about his dad, and at the end he was like, it was like his dad being tender in a way, and he was like, Hasan went, it was a real radbrowndads.tumblr.com moment.
That is perfect. Like, nice.
Okay. You know, it hit its audience, you know.
That is, I mean, there's something about it where you're like, look at these photos of your parents and you're like, God, who were you?
Yeah.
Like, now you're like kind of, you're all right, but you're like, there's all this like energy. There's like a strictness at times. And you're like, you know, I bet you used to be pretty cool before you started telling me I can't do anything. So,
yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, seeing your parents as people is like, it's a continual process that never ends, I feel like. And those pictures were very helpful for me. I mean, the main thing that was like, also like the first thing I ever wrote about was just like, why did my parents get married? Like, nobody wanted them to get married. Like, their parents were against it. You know, like, nobody showed up to their wedding besides like maybe some of my, like, my mom's siblings and like some of her close family, but it wasn't like a big event.
Why were your parents against it?
Yeah, why?
My grandparents. Yeah, duh. Why were your grandparents? Why were their parents? Yeah.
My parents obviously wanted to get married. Because of like casteism, you could say, and you know, a long history of like marrying, you know, each, they were both, you know, obviously in the same institution as doctors. So like whatever perception there was, like that one person's kid isn't good enough for the other or whatever, you know, like they just, like my dad's family, like married a certain group of people. My mom's family married a certain group of people. And then, you know, they also came to Pakistan at like, and left their communities in colonial India, and like all those ties between the families like got messed up. So like it's a new generation. It's like, you know, those old ways we used to marry, like they didn't really make much sense to my parents. Like my dad was like, there was no such thing in caste.
Yeah, it's all archaic and
So yeah, they just, people didn't show up to the wedding besides a few of my mom's family. My mom's family was a little more open-minded about it. My dad's family, like my dad is like, my dad looks so happy, aww, but only like one of his brothers is there, and like his mom's not there, and like his mom is like was like a widower, like he lost it. Like, so it's like, I look at those photos, I'm like, this is a crazy thing you did. Like basically,
they must have really loved each other to do that, right?
Yeah.
How did they meet? Yeah. Can I ask how they met?
I think they just were like in classes together. There was like five women in their class of like 50 or something, right? So there wasn't that many like the gender disparity as it probably still is in Pakistan to some extent.
Who knows?
Actually, I don't want to say that. I don't know for sure. Yeah. But at that time, they were like some of the first classes of women in that like were starting to come up, you could say, or like it was growing. It was a growing thing. So, you know, my mom was a very charismatic person. So I'm sure everybody knew her at the school. And my dad is a very friendly but quieter kind of figure. And I think they described themselves as like partners. Yeah. Like they would do like activism on campus. They would like agitate together.
What a beautiful start. I love that.
Yeah, it's great. So, you know, I first thing I ever wrote was for this book called Salam Love, which was about American Muslim men on like love stories. And I wrote about my parents' marriage because it was like helped me understand them better. I was like, okay, let's think about like why they did this. My dad is not very good at talking about this. So I kind of had to ask
I mean, most immigrant dads, I feel like they are so tight-lipped and hard to pry stuff out of.
Yeah. I would say only when I started later in life drinking with my dad did I get to know who he was as a person. Because that was the only time he opened up, was when he was like a little tipsy. And then also it helped when there were other family members around who he would be like reminiscing with. And then I would just casually be like, and so what about this? Like it was like almost strategic trying to learn about certain aspects of his life.
Yeah.
Because that's what you have to do.
I just put my dad on my podcast. And this part of him that is there, he just like feels like he needs to be present. So he turns on like in a way that he might not always when it's just me and him. Like, and I'm like, he's tired showbiz after a day of work. And I'm like, why did you marry mom? He's like,
And that was your podcast, See Something, Say Something?
Yeah, he was on a lot of those episodes. He was like a little bit of whenever I felt like I needed something interesting, I brought him on. Because he's a pretty great guy. Honestly, like I'm a big fan of him. In terms of, you know, I admire him a lot. Like there's a lot of elements of him that I aspire to. Both my parents, I feel like I wouldn't be who I was without them.
That's lovely.
Should we take this opportunity to go to a quick commercial break?
Yeah, sure. Let's do it.
All right, BRB.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Hey, this is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. As a nostalgic voice from your past, I'm here to remind you that amongst the stressful and chaotic existence we live in 2024, you deserve to get away. It's time for a vacation, no matter when you're hearing this. And let me tell you how you'll get there. The 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe. Want to bring the family to the mountains with the Santa Fe's available H-Track all-wheel drive? Well, it's got standard third-row seating and available dual wireless charging pads for the kids who just want to stare at their phone and not talk to you. You know what I mean. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
And we're back. We had just touched on the fact that we have a podcast called See Something, Say Something, which is about Muslim American life. And it started at BuzzFeed, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Well, can you tell us the process of how that came to be?
Sure. So after the blog Rad Brown Dads, I and not wanting to do a PhD, I just like applied to media jobs, and BuzzFeed like had a fellowship program where they kind of had like early mid-career people. I was actually kind of old at that time, or like everyone else was like early 20s. I was like 25 or 26, which at that time felt very old.
Was ancient.
Yeah, I was like, oh my God, everyone's a college grad. I just felt very old. But, you know, I like figured it was a way to pick up some skills. And I just basically would do the BuzzFeed thing, like write lists, like all this stuff. But I'd also do these kind of like cultural work occasionally where like during Ramadan, I would like call for outside voices and like try to like, you know, one of my big editorial mandates around See Something, Say Something and covering Muslims at BuzzFeed was like, you know, like a lot of times people like Pakistani Americans, for instance, get the mic around Muslim American issues. And I felt like that was very unequal and unfair. So I like wanted to share some of that space. So I'd like put out calls and I would like edit, commission essays and you know, do interviews and stuff where I would highlight different kinds of folks. And I, you know, I guess like editorial was just like building a podcast program at that time. There was this podcast, Another Round, which was like hugely influential on me, which was like two black women talking about their experience. So like I kind of took inspiration from that to do See Something, Say Something, where I was like trying to highlight different kind of viewpoints on American Muslims based off the work I did at BuzzFeed and my grad program where I'd like studied American Muslims in a professional sense.
So I had
some light qualifications to do that.
You have both sides, like academic and then actual real life.
Yeah. And I prefer to like have conversations, you know, that's like one of the great things about being a journalist. A lot of journalists are introverts, I find, but it's interesting. Like I just like talking to people. So like, I love just like being able to like have an excuse to talk to somebody for like an hour.
That's a good trait to have as a journalist and podcaster. Yeah. But I do want to mention, so when it debuted in 2016, it was very well liked and well known. New York Times called it one of the best new podcasts of the year, which is, I think that's a pretty big fucking deal. And it was on these like best of whatever lists. How did that, was that like translatable to your parents at all at the time?
Actually, I think a lot of people told me, I didn't understand what you were doing before you did this. So that was interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think it was translatable. People did listen to it. People in my family listened to it. Yeah, that was a great year for me, 2016. It was like Trump was like destroying the country. And I was like, wow, my life professionally is going great despite everything else burning down in America.
Yeah, that's similar to us because we were starting our podcast in 2016.
Nice.
We were like, we're all going to die, but we'll have some money in our bank account before we go.
Yeah. 2016 was when we filmed the short-lived YouTube series. That was a different time. We had different thoughts about
I'm going to dig that future. Up.
No, you don't have to dig it up. You could just search on YouTube. It's pretty. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to do it. That's what I'm going to do.
Life is weird like that. I mean, also on top of Trump taking over, it was like also we were having in conversations where we were finally like, oh, wait, we have to have these conversations because half this country is super racist and won't like they do that thing where they're like, I'm not racist. Mm-hmm. How could I be the good ones? Yeah. And you're like, we just voted for Trump. So I don't know if you know what that equates to exactly. Like that. That's what his whole the thing that they run on
campaign.
Is it campaign? Platform, whatever. Maybe. All of it platform is like very racist ideologies. So if you agree with, you know, but so it was such a strange time where all of a sudden you were like looking around and being like, the fuck are these people?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I still get so mad when my sister, there's like a couple of, I don't know. She knows some people through her husband that voted for Trump. And there's always like a rationale behind like why they still talk to them. But I always hate that because like, at the end of the day, Trump was all those things. But
yeah,
whatever. Regardless, I can't get over it. But did the blog and like writing and all of that, did that just naturally transition you into journalism, or like, was it like an unconscious decision? What was it?
I think I wasn't sure if I wanted to. I think I'm pretty platform agnostic, I guess I would say. Like, mm-hmm. I have worn a lot of hats. I've edited other people's work. I've like hosted food video series. Like, there was a period of time where we were doing a lot of food videos at BuzzFeed, which like, it's a kind of journalism, but it's really like, you know, it's like TV, I guess you could say. You know, I write a lot of personal essays and memoirs. I just kind of get bored easily. So I anything that lets me do a lot of different things, I will do. And mm-hmm. BuzzFeed at that time let me do a lot of different things. So, you know, I picked up a lot of journalistic skills. In some ways, I almost regret not being like formally trained as a journalist, but like, I don't regret like any of the moves I made, I guess you could say. Like, I needed to do that to get there. I thought journalism was something like white people did and to write about white people. I literally had no idea like it was an option for me to have like a beat that I could develop. So yeah, I learned it all on the job. You know, 2014, mm-hmm. I started that fellowship and I was just picking up skills along the way. Same thing with podcasting. You know, I started podcasting without knowing anything about podcasting.
Yeah, I mean, same.
Picked up the skills, yeah. And now I feel like, yeah, I mean, like I have a decent amount of skills in both those areas. Food writing too. I was just like, hey, well, like I'm at a media place. Like, why don't I write about food? Like,
you're a writer. I mean, yeah. That's the simplest way to put it, I guess.
Yeah.
But we get the multi-hyphenate life.
I don't think any of us need formal training in being a journalist because sometimes, I gotta say, some of these journalists, I mean, even some of these institutions, you're like, okay, so clearly ethics aren't really a thing going on here. But I mean, just like the New York Times in general, like their headlines and stuff. And you're like,
of course,
okay, Zion is trash. Yeah. Like, you're like, what? Like, have you even met an Iranian person? Like, you're like, what is happening here?
Yeah.
There's so much that you're like, okay, so maybe I could have spent like, whatever, hundreds of thousands of dollars going to grad school to like learn journalism, but then like work for New York Times and have zero power and be like, why would you make that the headline? And then you're like, oh, these people don't give a shit. It's so like frustrating. You may as well have your own blog.
So I never advise people to go to journalism school, just to be clear. When I mean training, I mean like working at like a paper.
Yeah.
I mean I was like working at not at the news side of BuzzFeed. I didn't work on a desk. Mm-hmm. I genuinely don't think anyone needs to go to journalism school, just to be clear. I just think I would like to have I think when I started doing journalism, I was already put into a beat of writing about American Muslims, and I had a certain expertise there, but it would be great to have a beat that was just me finding the story where it was. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That's what I mean. Like, something that, like, is, like, you know, the kind of the basis of journalism, like, beat reporting in some way or another. Like, that's the part that I skipped, I guess you could say. Like, I got thrust into, like, a personality role, and I was like, I kind of just want to write stuff. You know, like just talk to people and you figure out like what a good story is.
So. Well, your first mistake was being a diverse face.
Yeah, we can exploit him.
I don't know what you thought was going to happen when they were like, wow, and he can speak well. Well, let's get this guy in a visual place. And then it's like the college newsletter where you're like on every page all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. And you're like, wait, am I the only brown guy here? You're like, wait a second.
Last I checked, me and four other brown people who were all laid off were like on some like website of diversity,
of
you know, the thing where we were just like meeting to like figure out how to make the world a better place and didn't get laid off.
But I agree with you. I don't think we need journalism. Well, I don't think you should go to journalism school, but I understand what you mean now. Like if you had just like kind of worked your way up in that sort of like hustle where you had to learn to be like scrappy and get out there.
Yeah.
God,
I don't know. There are very few things I think we need school for. Film school, I think, is useless for to be honest, most of the time, other than like equipment that you have access to. But there's just like a certain, there's always like a barrier that separates people when it comes to education. Yeah. So I feel like unless you're doing like science and stuff that matters when it comes to other stuff, school is kind of a waste of time. But I don't know.
You heard it here first, guys. We do not endorse school.
No school here.
Not okay. The academic system here is broken. We all know it.
Yeah, I agree.
We don't like school, and that is okay. We don't have to like school.
No.
I don't like school.
You can't force us.
School was wasted on my ass. It really was. Like, I was out here like, in class all day.
No, I feel the same way.
Now, if I went to school, sure, yeah, I would probably add more to my life. But, like, when I was in college, oh, my God, useless. I was useless.
I feel like I should use this to promote the other podcast I'm working on, which is Radiolingo, which is
I wanted to bring that up.
Yeah, I will say one good thing about college, which is I did not know how to speak Urdu, which was my first language, very well until I went to college and then took classes. And to be honest, it made me, I would say fluent, but like I use it in my job more often than you'd think, like interviewing food, like in restaurants. I interview a decent amount of folks in Urdu. It's very helpful to be able
That's
to do
so
that.
Great. Oh, I love that. I love that you were able to like reconnect that, the gap that you probably experienced growing up.
Yeah. So this show that I have from Crooked and Duolingo, it's called Radiolingo. It's like about linguistics and how language shapes our world and how our world shapes language. And a lot of what I share is about, you know, my relationship to learning languages. And, you know, we talk to a lot of other people too, but like my personal story comes up quite a bit in there.
Do you guys talk about how that damn owl has a chokehold on me?
Do you know that the owl is Pakistani?
Is what?
The TikTok owl is Pakistani.
Duo is Pakistani?
If you go to the TikTok account, the person who runs the Duo page is their name is Zarina.
Wow. And I didn't know that.
So I'm like, there's two iconic Duolingo Pakistanis now. It's me and Serena.
Damn.
I'm like, solidarity.
It's fucking me up.
Maybe not the owl on the app. The owl on the app, maybe that's...
The owl on the app is dangerous.
Yeah.
This owl is up in my business all day like... You lost your position.
It's very passive-aggressive. Like, very passive-aggressive.
Like, I will get to you. And it's like, will you, though? And you're like, why are you taunting me?
Yeah.
And anyway, now I'm like on a billion-day streak because I'm scared of an owl on my phone.
It's very effective, apparently.
Yeah, I'll hunt you down.
Well, one of the things that I talked about is in Urdu, the owl is not a smart creature. It's a dumb creature. Oh. So like you call somebody a son of an owl when you want to call them an idiot.
That's such a like opposite thing
I know,
in
right?
American culture. It's so interesting.
Yeah.
Son of an owl.
Oh, like a wise old owl. Yeah. JK, you're an
idiot.
Ulu.
You're an owl. You're an idiot. You're a fool. That's
you stupid owl.
Yeah.
It's like, okay. Oh, that owl wants my blood.
Should we take our last break and then come back? Let's do it.
I guess.
BRB.
We're gone.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Hey, this is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. As a nostalgic voice from your past, I'm here to remind you that amongst the stressful and chaotic existence we live in 2024, you deserve to get away. It's time for a vacation, no matter when you're hearing this. And let me tell you how you'll get there. The 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe. Want to bring the family to the mountains with the Santa Fe's available H-Track all-wheel drive? Well, it's got standard third-row seating and available dual wireless charging pads for the kids who just want to stare at their phone and not talk to you. You know what I mean. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562 562- 314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
And we're back. Ahmed and the Duolingo Island both now have chokeholds around our neck. We have to go do our Turkish studies. I do my Turkish on there.
You do Turkish. Cool.
Yeah, I do Turkish because, well, it's, I don't, my family speaks, or my dad's side of the family speaks as a Turkish. So it's, you know, a slightly different dialect, but similar enough that if I were to speak like Istanbuli Turkish to them, they would understand it.
Cool.
So I'm learning that Turkish because Azeri Turkish, unfortunately, is not a written language. So you can't just like go learn it somewhere.
Yeah, languages.
But you know what? I would love, hey, tell this to your little duo friends over there. They got to get Farsi. Because like while I can speak Farsi, I would love to be able to like, you know, because I have such a like, I have slang Farsi. That's how I speak to my family. Right. Everyone is like, I'm not formal in Farsi. I would love to learn more like formal Farsi because sometimes I'll be talking. My mom would be like, God, you're such trash. Like, what are you even saying? And I'm like, what? Sorry, my Farsi's so fucking, you know, whatever. But that's like streets. How I spoke. Yeah, it's how I grew up speaking. So like, I'm fluent in slang Farsi. I would love to learn more sort of formal Farsi and like, but you know what? Talk to your duo pals. Tell them.
It's on the list. It's on the list.
It would be great.
I'm also trying to get them to... I'm trying to learn... Well, there's a lot of languages I'd like to learn. I'd like to learn Punjabi. I'd like to learn Farsi. I just like... I have these dreams for
learning. Well, if you know Urdu, it's similar to Farsi. There's so much overlap, you know?
You guys say Khuda Hafiz.
Khuda Hafiz. I love doing that.
We say Khuda Hafiz. You say Khuda Hafiz.
Yeah, I love it. When I say goodbye to my parents, I'm like, Khuda Hafiz. My dad's like, stop. And I'm like, sorry. Sorry, I'm a modern Muslim woman. Khuda Hafiz. And my dad doesn't think it's funny. Like I do.
What does that mean?
Goodbye.
Oh, okay.
It's like God. It's like God protecting but it means goodbye.
Goodbye, but also Khuda, which is God, is like... I got your back, bro. You go with God.
Yeah. Some words are so similar to Arabic and Farsi, and others are just completely, like, I have no idea. Like that one.
Well, the interesting interesting language anecdote about that is in Pakistan, when Zia-ul-Haq, who's like a dictator that had a violent taking over of the country, he did some Islamization things that really messed up the country and we're still dealing with. But one of the cultural things that changed was people are still like, Khuda is not God. Allah is God. So we now say Allah Hafiz. So sometimes my parents came in the 70s before that. So I say Khuda Hafiz and people will go, Allah Hafiz. Like I'm like a worse Muslim than them because I use a different word for God than they use.
So layered.
Still say Allah. Like when you say like, inshallah, like you still say it.
You still say
it. You still technically say Allah, but like, but there's also just Khuda Hafiz is classic. That's a classic.
But just like, you know, in English, when I say God, it means Allah. Like it's the same thing. It doesn't mean.
Yeah,
like,
just a word.
But it's like the Lord, God. Like there's so much like, it's not like you're like, God, bye. Like you're like, it doesn't... Just relax. It's fine. Doesn't make any difference.
Yeah, that's interesting.
We're all God's children.
We're all something. I don't know what. I do.
My boyfriend just texted me, inshallah. Nice. He's white. He's funny. He hangs out my Muslim mom so much. He always goes, yeah, inshallah. And I'm like, dude.
Inshallah is useful. It's a useful word.
He always says it. And I'm like, you're so hilariously white, but you've hung out with a little Muslim woman for so long that you are also like, inshallah, it'll work out.
Inshallah.
And I'm like, wow.
Inshallah.
You're turning into my mom.
It works. My mom did that to my brother-in-law. Like, he says, like, very particular Arab words, like, shukran, like, thank you, and goodbye, and, like, this is yummy.
Shaitan. Like, I always tell him he's a shaitan, and he's like, no, I'm not.
That's funny.
What was it, the Rami? There's always three.
Yeah.
Before you get married, the one in the middle is shaitan.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
In a relationship. Yeah. Don't forget, you guys.
Classic. Classic.
Shaitan.
Can you tell us a little bit about the piece that won you this James Beard Award?
Definitely, yeah. Well, what's so funny about that piece is it got rejected so many times before it was accepted. Yeah. In fact, I pitched it to what I thought was a perfect home for it. And now looking back is not the perfect home for it. I'm glad that it didn't get picked up there. But they were like, yeah, it doesn't feel like it has characters or something. That was like the response, which is like, okay, fine. Well, it's a mystery to me. And I did many iterations of it before it became that written piece. I did like two podcast versions of it before it became a written piece. And I was like, I needed to write it down. So essentially what it is like I discovered through my family that there is this like national business happening of these Pakistani logistics experts or something like who have developed this customer base of like customers on WhatsApp who pay $40 for 2 kilograms of mangoes and like buy them on WhatsApp and then have them shipped to airport yards. And people like will buy like $300 minimum orders of like, you know, of these mangoes imported from Pakistan. And so that was really strange to me that first of all, people were paying that much. Second of all, that people were driving to the airport to pick it up from cargo. Like the first time I did it, like my cousin was like, hey, I have this order of Pakistani mangoes. Like, can you go get them for me? I was like, sure. Where do you go? To the airport. And I go to the like Southwest cargo bay and it's like this spooky place with like you know, and I just like give him my, I show him a WhatsApp message and he's like, okay, yeah, you're here for the mangoes. I was like, this seems so not,
hey,
like
man,
this should
be
legal. It didn't seem legal at all to me. And yeah, he like pulled up the thing and I took these mangoes, and they're considered some of the best mangoes in the world. Like everyone argues what the best mangoes in the world are, but if you know like about, you know, how a lot of food science goes, like places where the product originates tend to have more genetic diversity. So for coffee people, Ethiopia is considered one of the best, like it's the birthplace of coffee. Mm-hmm. That's where the coffee bean is indigenous to. So they have more genetic diversity within Ethiopian coffee beans than like all the stuff that's grown in South America. You could probably find more in Ethiopia than all of the South American coffee production. So mangoes are similar. So Pakistan and India and Bangladesh, like a lot of South Asia, it's considered by many people to be the home of mangoes, although there was some debate when I looked into it. And so they have some of the best mangoes in the world. People think the Alfonso in India is the best. Pakistanis argue that theirs is just as good. And so, yeah, like people are buying them not just because they want to eat them, but because there's so much pride in the mango. Like Pakistan is this place that doesn't get its respect, and we have one of the best things in the world. Like we're going to do everything we can get to bring it to America and share it with people. And that's what like a lot of people do. They'll like make these big group WhatsApp groups where like the, like I've done this now at this point. I make no profit off of it, but like people know me as somebody who's written this article about the mangoes and like this WhatsApp.
You're the mango
economy.
Guy.
And so like I do an order and I get like 35 boxes, and like, you know, people who have never had a mango that good will come and spend $40 and pick it up. And like, they'll be like, you know, I had like one friend who like had it at like a Shabbat dinner. Like, they took the Pakistani mangoes to the Shabbat dinner. So it's become this kind of thing. And like, it's not easy what they're doing. Like, it's not a big economy. Like, there's probably like 600,000 tons or something like that of mangoes imported to the United States every year. It's like a lot. And this is like 200 tons. It's not much, but it's like a lot of work what they're doing, because the mangoes also like go bad in like 2 or 3 days.
Right. They have to like, fly.
They have to fly. Like mangoes that we get in the US on supermarket shelves are pretty, they're big, and they last a long time. They don't taste good. They don't smell like flowers. These ones smell like flowers. They don't have a good texture. Like they're bred for the supermarket. Whereas these are like more of like a luxury product. They're only available for a couple of weeks during the summer from like May until August. And so people will do like anything to get them when they can. So that's it. And I have a bunch of guys now. I have a bunch of mango guys. I have like a guy in Chicago who has like a warehouse. There's a guy in New York who has a van. Actually, he's in Massachusetts, maybe, I think, or Connecticut. And he drives around the East Coast with a van full of mangoes.
A mango
van.
Have to,
yeah, you just get them out of the van. It's like, it's really, it's been really fun. And like every time I look back into it, it gets more silly and funny. It's also hilarious. That's part of it.
Well, so, I mean,
yeah,
that's the only kind of dealing I want to exist. Like fruit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good fruit.
It feels like a dealer. It definitely feels like you're dealing with a dealer. It's like, you know, can you cut me a discount because I'm buying 20 of them.
Hey, man.
You know?
Can you help me out?
I'm feeding. I'm feeding.
That's pretty crazy. It's like the raisin sort of pistachio game out of Iran.
Oh, tell me about that.
Something
I don't
I've
know
noticed.
About
yeah. Well, here's the thing. Customs' favorite thing is to try and be like, did you bring pistachios back? When they ask where you were from, you're like, no. Then you like shake the thing. It's like,
it's like you open your pockets.
That's
like,
yeah.
They fly out.
Like they know what we Persians are up to, which is bringing like 10 pounds of pistachios and raisins back from Iran. And it is literally like, my mom would be like, no, don't pack that much. And I'd be like, why? She's like, because we're going to put a fucking shit ton of pistachios in your suitcase. And you're like, well, shit, so what do I not bring clothes? And they're like, well, you need to be more economic about what you're bringing. We'll do laundry God, there. So but you need to be respectful for the fact that we have to bring 40 pounds of pistachio back, okay? Like, they will bring suitcases inside a suitcase, and, like, it's a whole racket. Like, everyone does it. Customs is fully aware we're doing it. We don't claim any of it. You don't claim it. Do not claim it. I'll tell you now. They will take that shit away from you if you claim it. You have to be sneaky. You put pants around that shit. You do whatever you can.
I want to try these now. I would read a piece about that. I
can't blow up anyone's spot. Unfortunately, this is like, we need to be cool. We are technically still Iranian. They do not respect us.
Yes, right.
I can't blow up my parents' spot. They'll be like, are you fucking out of your mind?
So I forgot the other thing about the mangoes, which is they were banned from being imported until like 2010 or 11, because of some FDA regulation around like invasive species.
Yeah.
And they were like, okay, you can bring them in, but you have to irradiate them. You have to take them to like a high-tech facility. There's like 4 of them in the country, and irradiate the mangoes, and then you can sell them. So like that is like a
What does irradiate mean?
Irradiate, well, in this case, it's electron beam. It's not like nuclear radiation. That's typically what people think of. It's not like they're not radioactive. They're not nuking the mangoes. They're doing what's an electron beam. They like fire a highly concentrated wave of energy. I'm not a scientist, so please.
This sounds fake.
Yeah, I know.
He's lying.
Basically, this electron beam causes any potential mango weevils or mango seeds to like be unable to sprout when they come to the U.S. It's not that they're unsafe for you to consume, but if they came and got they sprouted here, they could kill local mangoes, of which there are not that many, by the way. There's not a big mango industry in the United States, but just for in case we ever want to grow mangoes, we wouldn't want to be devastated by these mango weevils. So they like irradiate them in order to remove it.
Whoa. Well, that's all of that. All veggies, all fruit. That's why you're not supposed to take them state to state. They don't want you bringing things that could contaminate the current like ecosystem.
Yeah. Right. Canada doesn't have this regulation, so you could. Before I did this piece, I had never had a Pakistani mango, by the way. I should mention that. They're so hard to get because they were banned in the United States. So people would go to Canada and try to and get them where they're easier to get and smuggle them over the border.
Wow.
Like what you're describing with the pistachios. Like some people I knew said they like hid them in their suitcase and all this stuff. And I knew another person who like would just go and like spend a weekend and just eat mangoes the whole weekend because they couldn't take them
That's
over.
How I want to do
They'd
that.
Book a hotel
Damn,
room.
That is the life.
Yeah, so people are really passionate about their mangoes.
So that's the piece. So you wrote a piece about it, like after making 2 podcasts about it. And then where did it eventually get published?
So yeah, I pitched it to Eater. I had this podcast. I was like, I have all this work. I have a little bit more. The other thing that was annoying and made me think like, is there something illegal going on here? Is the people wouldn't talk to me. I was chasing them for years. At one point I flew to Texas to talk to a guy and I met him in person. I was like, I'm at your store. And he was like, okay. And we started talking. He was like, don't turn the microphone on. I was like, okay, we talked for half an hour. And I went, okay, can I turn the microphone on? He was like, come back tomorrow. And I was like, no. We are talking today because otherwise I will never talk to you again. So like these people were kind of like, I was kind of like struggling to get them on the microphone, I guess you could say. And so this one person source who I'd been chasing for a very long time finally said yes after the podcast had come out and was a great source. I don't know why it took me so long to connect to them, but like they were very forthcoming once I talked to them. But so I had all this extra information. So I pitched it to Eater, like I have this extra information that didn't make it into the podcast. Like, can I write it? I wrote 10,000 words, the first draft I wrote. I had so much material.
Wow.
They wanted 3,000. So then I cut it down to 5,000 and then we cut it down to like 4,000 or 3,000 or something. And yeah, I published it and it had like it was like probably one of my more successful articles, you could say. Like it definitely developed an audience, like a lot of like...
Hey, what an award. What are you talking about?
I know, but like when you first publish a piece, you don't know how big of a... you know, it doesn't always have a long tail. You know, sometimes you'll publish a piece, you spent like years working on like a long time working on it and it doesn't, you know. But it developed an audience, you know. That was nice. People like started buying the mangoes. Like it had an interactive component because people were like, I want to find the mangoes locally. It was something that they had never heard of, you know. And it had a bigger audience than the podcast. And so I asked the Eater folks and I, try, like, would they submit it for the award? And they did, and I was nominated. And there was only two other people in the category. It was for feature writing. Mm-hmm. And then I went to the James Beard Awards in Chicago, and I met Padma Lakshmi, who's one of my icons from Top Chef. Briefly, she had no idea who I was, but Legend. She was very nice.
She's a goddess.
Let me know if you need any mangoes, Padma.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, and then I won there. I was with my wife. It was wonderful. I met a lot of my peers there. I'm not like a very prolific food writer, but so like I felt like if I didn't win this one, it would be many years before I'd write another piece that would be qualified for this. So I was very happy. Like I was like so over the moon, and I still feel, you know, like it's a huge blessing to get something that's so quirky. It's just like so me. It's like a quirky story. It's not like an extremely serious story. It's like a weird little niche subculture that you wouldn't know about if you weren't, you know, like most Pakistanis you speak to don't even know you can get Pakistani mangoes in the United States. It's still like within Pakistanis, it's a niche thing. Mm-hmm. But since shining a light on it, maybe more people know. But I still think you'd be surprised maybe, despite like mangoes being like a symbol of Pakistani identity, a lot of people have no idea how to get them. And this is the only way. Yeah. Like this is the only way to do it, really.
Do you remember the first time you had one of the mangoes, that experience?
Yeah. I picked it up for my cousin from that airport, and the car smelled like flowers. It was like I had like flowers for a wedding. Like that's how intense the flower. It wasn't like, oh, it like smells kind of good in here. It was like, whoa, this is like overpowering. I've never smelled anything like this before. And since then, it's a consistent feature that isn't like when I bring them to my apartment smells like flowers. Wow. So then there was two types. One is called a Jansa. One is called an Unveritol. Unveritol is like a small little guy who's like kind of, I think, I want to say, I'm mixing up the colors now. But one of them is like a bright orange and one of them is a pale yellow. And they both are like custardy kind of. They have like a much nicer, you can kind of like eat it with a spoon like it's a custard. It's very juicy, very sweet. Like the Jansa in particular had this like grassy kind of flavor, which I had never tasted in a fruit. And it was just best fruit I've ever had in my life. I mean, straight up, just nothing better than that, honestly, to me.
I got to get one of these mangoes.
Let's do it. Where's everyone located again? Is it
Los Angeles? We're both in LA. Los Angeles, let us know. Right? I'll drive to LAX, even though it's hell.
I have a friend.
Burbank, maybe.
I have a friend of a friend who does some organizing of it. I can try to connect you.
That would be awesome. I need to try these mangoes.
You can Shereen coordinate it yourself.
I'll pick you up. We're going to LAX, baby. <Let's go. laughs> We're getting to the mangoes.
You can coordinate it yourself, but it's like kind of annoying. It's better to group by because either like they don't want to deal with so many people and they want
how big
orders.
Is a group?
Well, minimum orders 8 boxes, which is about $300.
I can afford that.
But even that is a pretty small order. Like they want you to order like 40. So sometimes if you're not ordering like 40, they might not respond to you. So
how many did you order?
I typically order like 20 to 25 at this point. Wow. I only eat 2 or 3 myself, but people
and then
want
you
them.
Just give them to everyone?
I give them or, you know, I pass them along at cost. I don't, you know.
Oh,
because
someone's flipping mangoes.
I'm not making any money off of it. Cost. At cost. I just.
Sure, I got you at cost, wink. So, throw a dollar on there, honey. You make some money.
That's what everyone tells. It's funny. Everyone tells me this. They're like, you should make money. I'm like, I think it's a journalistic malfeasance if I do that.
See what I mean? Not even professionally trained journalists on the beat still has ethics. Incredible.
Yeah, that's right. Better than the New York Times.
Yeah, 100%
better. Fucking Zionist Times. What am I saying? Incredible.
The only thing they did right is call See Something, Say Something. Good podcast. Yeah, that's the only
thank
thing
you,
that's
thank
right.
You,
I'll give them
thank
that.
You,
but. Yeah.
Just remind me when May rolls around. That's when they start coming
perfect.
In.
I'm going to put it on my calendar. Am I even kidding? I need a mango like that.
But here's the thing is also there's like a mix of varieties. And some of them people don't like as much. And you'll be like, why did I do this? But everyone likes different ones. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So the one that I think is like so amazing, other people are like, I don't like that one. And I don't want it. Because they're wildly different from each other.
Interesting. So how different are they from the the mango we get in this country?
The closest mango that you would get in this country is called a Atolfo, champagne, or honey.
I was going to say champagne because those are pretty good. And
those are pretty good.
It's a pale yellow that you described, but
I don't know any of
them. The mango industry has been trying to bring the yellow ones in. And typically, mangoes in most parts of the world are yellow. The most popular mango in the U.S. is the big green and red ones, which are like, I think, Tommy Atkins, maybe? Or
they're so cumbersome.
And those are bad. Those are just like, they're just bad. I mean, I enjoyed them growing up. Like, mango is my favorite fruit growing up, but like, it's such a pale imitation compared to what those ones are like.
Yeah.
But I think the champagne, like, at their best, they're reaching there. Like, but you know, like, there's a wide variety, I guess you could say. I don't think I had any bad ones from Pakistan. Like, I had some that went brown, I guess, but they still had like the smell, for instance. Champagne don't smell floral. They don't have some of the subtler flavors, I guess. They're not as juicy, but they're a better approximation of what you would like. I don't think I've ever had champagne. I think I've only eaten
those Tommy Atkins ones. I'm not a big mango person because I don't like hunt for it.
I'm a fruit fiend. Costco, even like growing up, they have just boxes of cut mango that are way too expensive, but I would beg and I would always get them. But they're probably the shitty ones, and the champagne ones are so much better.
Yeah.
But if they're not even close to the real thing, I'm sure.
You might be hearing a lot of baby and parent noises outside because I think my sister is visiting and seeing my daughter. So sorry.
No, we like the texture. You're probably hearing some type of airplane that just went over my head.
But my recommendation to you, Anna, if you've not had them, is to find ones that are from the majority of mangoes in America are from Mexico.
Okay.
And there are some good varieties from Mexico, but most of the varieties you get from Mexico are not very good, sorry to say. So try to find them from the Caribbean or other countries, and that's typically where you'll find a higher quality mango. Mm. So like Haitian is quite good.
How do I find these?
You just have to look at the tag.
Where do I go?
There's like a guy in my neighborhood in New York who used to sell Haitian ones, and occasionally they were very, very good.
Yeah, just look at the tag, like the source of them or whatever.
Okay.
Also, the other thing you can do is have a kindly uncle with a mango tree in Florida who needs to get rid of them. In the course of the story,
I'll do that.
yeah. There's like all these Pakistani uncles in Florida. I met one in the story, and he's been sending me mango. Like, I don't know if you know, mango trees, they give like hundreds of mangoes.
How do
like,
you send mangoes safely?
I text my
they
dad.
Just pack them into a UPS box, USPS wow. box, and send them to me. And one of those mangoes was so incredible. Wow. I was like, oh my God, these are so good.
Wait, what's the shelf life on these though?
So, you mean the Pakistani ones?
Yeah, like if they're coming all the way from Pakistan and you get this whole box, like what's the shelf life?
Well, they try to make it so that they are ripen when they arrive, like they're like half ripe when they leave, and then they like try to be ripe around the time they arrive.
Mm-hmm.
The best varieties are bad in 2 or 3 days.
Oh my God.
They go bad really fast. The best varieties. So that's the other issue why like they don't show up in supermarkets. One of the people said that they got them in like Costco or Aldi or something, and they were like, the supermarket was like, we're never buying these again. They were $8. They went brown in like 2 days, and like nobody wanted to buy them.
I have an idea.
What's that?
The ones that you don't finish before they go bad, you cut them up, you open them up, you cut them up, and you freeze them.
Yeah.
I've never tried that,
but people say it doesn't work as well with these because they're very juicy. They're not
or
as like firm.
Make 10 pounds of smoothie.
Yeah, we make smoothies. We make smoothies in mango milkshake, which is like ice cream and milk and mangoes. Like, that's a good way to use them. So,
all right. I texted my dad, have you considered planting a mango tree? Because he has fig, plum, oranges, and lemons. He's in Northern California.
Okay.
Sort of.
That might be a little too cold. Yeah, it might be too cold for mangoes.
But I don't know. He plants all sorts of fruits and veggies. So maybe if he'll do it, I would love that.
Florida and SoCal.
Oh, you responded. Places. Mangoes grown in tropical environments. Thanks a lot, Dad.
That's a good dad right there. Yeah, Florida and SoCal.
He knows. He knows.
I wrote, okay, fine. God. It's so hard to get a damn mango.
That's what I did with persimmons and my mom. My mom also has like citrus and mulberries. Ooh. The mulberries are amazing. But the persimmon, we have a persimmon tree because I'm obsessed with persimmons. They're my favorite fruit. And yeah, you can convince your parents, I think.
Do you like the astringent or non-astringent persimmons?
The ones that are like tomato-y, the non-astringent ones, the fuyu. Okay. They're like more stout than long.
Okay. I'm very new to persimmons, but I think I like them a lot.
They're just like,
and I don't think I've probably had good ones still, and I still like them.
You have to like not get them unripe, but after a certain point, even if they're crunchy, they're good. But the more they get gooey and like just pudding like, oh my God, it's the best fruit of all time. It probably is like even better because it's like limited availability here, like 1 month of the year. But I just love persimmons.
That's you should bring some to my mom. My mom makes what is it? It's not like fruit roll up, whatever, like dried fruit roll up in a way, but there's another name.
Dehydrated?
For it. Dehydrated fruit. And she makes a lot of jam. Oh my God. I have some fig jam she made in my fridge right now. Oh my God.
What is the Persian term for that dehydrated fruit? You know?
We call it lavashak.
Nice. Yeah. We call it bopper.
Bopper. I don't know how it translates to English. We always said lavashak. I don't know what the English version of it is.
Yeah.
I say fruit roll up because that's how I see it. Like it's a fruit roll up kind of.
It is a fruit roll up.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like a lot of our food cultures are, we take a lot from Persian culture. So I'm always surprised. Like, for instance, you guys have zalabiya, is it called? It's like the yellow circular thing with the sugar syrup. We call it jalebi.
Oh, yeah. What is that? It's like, oh my God, I'm blanking.
It's like rice flour, maybe? With sugar syrup, something like that. It's like fried.
It's like fried, but also like so aggressively covered in like syrup.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. If you've ever had them fresh and hot, I think they're much better. Those are off the street. It's a good street food. It's like a sweet pretzel, almost, is how I would describe it.
I love how much we all love food, like because of our cultures. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like I love that.
It's like there's different kinds, but I was just like bamia. Like
That's the other term I've heard for it.
And then there's like zulbia. There's all the different shapes. Because there's like the little like sort of like chicken nugget looking ones. They're not chicken nuggets, but they just look like chicken nuggets. But then there's like the swirly weird ones.
Yeah, that's the one that we have a cousin of. Ours is bright orange and yours is like yellow.
Yeah. I don't love it. I don't know. I think it's just. It's
have you ever had it fried
syrup.
Off the street? Have
no,
you ever had
I don't
it
think
fried
so.
Off the street?
I think I've always just had it as like at my parents' house.
It's not good cold. You have to have it from like a man with a giant beard who dips it into the oil, then dredges it in sugar, and you have it hot with like a dirty newspaper around it, and it crisps. It's like crispy and sweet and hot. That's the way to have it.
I will. Yeah, I guess I don't. I never really enjoyed the syrup of it all. I just thought it's so like it's just too much.
It is very sweet.
Yeah.
There's a lot of sugar syrup and rose water syrup situation.
Yeah, like they put like some saffron. Persians do like saffron.
Yeah, I can see that.
It's a lot. Yeah. Persian desserts are interesting. They're either like very chalky or like syrupy. And you're like, can we get something in between?
You guys, we use a lot of cheese in our desserts. You guys use cheese?
Is kanafa also Syrian?
Kanafa.
Yeah,
we have kanafa.
Right.
My mom makes amazing kanafa.
Ooh, that's a great one.
But like halawat jibin is like literally like sweet. Cheese, like there's a lot of dairy in our dessert. Obviously, there's like also like the little petit fours and the baklava and like all of that. But I noticed the other day when my sister had a baby shower and my mom went very glam and made it very Arab and there was catering from this guy that we're obsessed with. But I noticed then that I was like, a lot of our desserts are dairy because I had to take a lactate because I don't do dairy. It hurts me. But in that moment, I was like, wow, all of these amazing desserts that I grew up with, a lot of them have dairy. And also like the rose water that you're talking about and all of that stuff. So, yeah.
I don't know what happened in the Persianate world, like also including South Asians and like just like the Ottoman Empire. Like there's all this dairy in all of our desserts and we're all lactose intolerant. Like
all
what happened there? Like you can't blame colonialism. You can't
it's
blame
literally
colonialism
a thing.
For that.
It's very common for that region.
That's just how we do it. That's how we do it.
Yeah, like we have like rasmalai or like dohi. These are all like dairy-based things.
Yeah, we have like in Iran, we have dugh, which is like carbonated yogurt.
Yeah, dugh.
Yeah. Oh, we have, what's it called?
You can't digest that shit.
Iran is the Turkish version, right?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Yeah, and then we have, I mean, lassi, right? Lassi is like, these are all like sister drinks, like salty or sweet yogurt drinks.
But you're right.
Also,
because
falude.
What is that?
We also have that. We also have falude,
like,
but I think it's different.
It's like noodle dessert. It's like ice cream noodles.
It's a vermicelli. Yeah, it's a sweetened vermicelli.
That's really funny.
Ice cream noodles.
You've had it before.
There's a place that I went to when I was in India where they do a block of ice cream, kulfi, and then they just put the noodles right on top and you just eat it like out of a metal container and it's pretty delicious, honestly.
We really know how to do food.
You know what it's like? It's like boba. Think of it like boba, like in boba noodles. That's what the texture is kind of like.
Yeah.
Interesting. Like tapioca.
It might be tapioca or vermicelli. I'm a food writer, so I should know these things. So sometimes I should make sure I'm right about this.
No, I
think it's vermicelli.
I love fucking food. I can talk about this all day. We can stay here for another 5 hours just talking about our food. I'm sure.
By the way, I Googled Iranians bringing pistachios into the U.S. just to see if there was anything out there, and there's nothing. Like, we are, like, so, like, you don't talk about
it. You got to pitch that story.
Should we cut this all out?
There's only articles about how, like, there's, like, because of, you know, sanctions and stuff, it's, like, banned. Yeah. And, like, also to help, like, California pistachio grows. But all it's all just so, like, it's not spoken about. It's the secret
story right there.
Every Persian who comes through in America, if you check their luggage,
yeah,
there's some unclaimed pistachios slash raisins in there.
Yeah. The keeping
or
the suitcase.
Any nut mix, really.
Yeah.
We have that culture too, by the way, pistachios and dried fruits. But yeah. I don't know of anyone trying to bring it over. That doesn't seem like something.
Well, yeah, because they're not telling you.
Yeah, right.
You'll try and write about it and blow up their spot.
Yeah, like I did with the mangoes.
They're like, keep it from Ahmed.
Yeah. I feel like every culture probably has that thing where, like, keep your suitcase empty. We're bringing this back, right?
Yeah.
Like, for us, it's like za'atar and like a lot of spices that are much better over there.
Oh, yeah, saffron.
Like little things like that where it's like, you got, this is the time to stock up.
Yeah, saffron. And also, I'll be like putting like Persian rugs in my suitcase. I'll just be like,
that's a good one, though.
You gotta get everything into America.
That's worth it.
Well, that scene in Mo, have you all seen Mo on Netflix?
Yeah. Yes.
Where he like has his little bottle of olive oil.
Yeah, exactly.
That was my buddy from college that had like his family farm's olive oil that he would just like take around with him. It was like, it didn't seem all that unrealistic to me. And za'atar as well. Yeah.
Tahini is one of those things I get really angry at Americans for, because it is disgusting the way that it is made here. I will just say it like flat out. For example, the Whole Foods tahini, it tastes like ass. An actual tahini tastes amazing.
Right.
And unless you have like an Arabic store near you that like import stuff like that you can get some of these things at.
Yeah.
It's just not the same. So you have these like terrible versions of things that are supposed to be delicious that you can only get when you're like connected or traveling. So I don't know.
You don't ride for Ziad the brand? Do you think Ziad the brand is any good?
It has its moments, but...
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah, it has its moments. I just recently got obsessed with a new brand. There's an Arabic store. We call it the Arabic store, but it's called North Park Produce, where my parents live. But everyone calls it the Arabic store, even though it has like Russian stuff and all of that.
Yeah, right.
But my mom found these coconut cookies, and it's like Abraham Bakery. And I've been looking them up because I'm like, I need to get more of these cookies. It's just like a thing. Like all of these little, I don't know. It's just so cute. I like us.
I wanted Abraham Bakery cookies. That sounds good.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll all have to exchange, ship some food to each other.
Yeah.
I did look up that restaurant we went to that was really nice called Bad Hunter, but it's closed since the pandemic.
Oh, no.
It was good. It was like plant-based. It was really good.
Are you all vegan?
Oh, no.
No.
Oh, I was vegan at the time.
Okay, got it.
You're not vegan anymore?
It's a whole thing.
Revelations on the ethnically ambiguous.
No, it's just like, I just feel like any kind of restriction has been not good for me. Like I had an eating disorder when I was younger and it like really fucked up my health. And I think everyone in general should eat what makes them feel good. And that's it. There's no labels. There's no
You're
anything.
You're only eating red meat,
you know?
Now.
But I've been dabbling in things that I haven't had in a long time, because when I travel to Mexico City, for example, I was still in that like really restrictive mindset. I didn't try a lot of food because I was like, I can't eat this. Like I am vegan. But now I think if I go to Japan, I'm going to eat sushi. Right. You know what I mean? Like there are things where you just like, I don't know. I think everyone should eat whatever they want. There are no labels involved and that's fine.
Yeah, I like that. I like to eat everything.
Yeah.
Even sometimes where I'm like, that'll hurt my stomach, but I have to try it.
Yeah, take a lactate. That's what I do.
No, I don't acknowledge my lactose intolerance at all, like whatsoever. Even though like my whole life, my mom had to like boil my milk for me because I can't drink it.
Does that help? Does it kill the lactose?
I don't know. I can drink like hot milk. I can't drink cold milk.
Oh.
But I don't let it stop me. I just go on like a fart rampage.
You're like my little sister.
I'm not stopping because I enjoy taste so much. I enjoy like that more than I enjoy like not having stomachache. You know, like I just don't care. I'm like, it's fine. Because then I get to enjoy it and try this and have this like feeling and like be like, wow, that is something someone put together, not even knowing at first if it was going to hit right. And like created this palette. Like it's incredible. Like food at like very nice restaurants. And I don't really consider myself a foodie, but I guess I don't know what I consider myself. But like I love trying new food. And also I love trying restaurants where like you're like, wow, this chef is this chef knows what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And like randomly, I'll like, I don't know, like I will do my like searches when I travel. And if I'll become like fixated on a restaurant. I don't know. I did this in Copenhagen at Sanchez, Rocio Sanchez's restaurant. And I was like, I will get a reservation. I called every single day. They were just all booked. And then one day they were like, fine, come. Whoa. You just keep calling. And I was like, thanks. I'm only here for like a week. Please. And they like let me in. And it was fucking incredible. And her, wow. You know, like she's an incredible chef. She's from the Noma of it all. We're not going to get into that toxic hellhole. But like it was, I was, and then you know what? I was just kind of like, all right, I had it.
I was just like, okay. I'm all about any place where I don't have to get a reservation. I can just walk in. I can't plan ahead.
Well, that's the thing. I can't either. And that's why I like became so fixated. All of a sudden I was like, I didn't think of this through at all, but I'm just going to harass these people until they let me come eat. And it worked.
They're going to remember you forever.
Oh, man.
You're going to be that person that comes back. Yeah. But for real, we can talk about food for hours. So before we go down that road, okay, thank you so much for being here.
So good to be
here. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great to, you know, spend the time with you. And hopefully we'll be able to share some mangoes or something.
Yes.
Oh, we're getting some mangoes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Just remind me.
We will.
Oh, I will.
You won't be able to get rid of us. Where can people find you and follow your work?
So I'm mostly on Twitter at RadBrownDads, my old Tumblr account is now my Twitter account, like I said. And also, I think, you know, the whole first season of Radio Lingo, the show that I did with Crooked Media and Duolingo about language and how it shapes our world, is out on podcast platforms. There's a lot of fun different topics in there. We talk about pronouncing names. We talk about the challenge of subtitling in different places. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, Shireen, do you know about potentially Captain Majid?
Captain Majid?
Yeah.
Are you kidding me? Yeah, I know about Captain Majid.
Okay.
It was like the thing growing up. I mean, it's an anime, right?
That's the thing. Captain Majid is the Arabic name, the Arabic dub of the Japanese anime. But most Arabs that I know don't know that it's not Egyptian. People think it's straight up not Japanese. Like, I was like, you know, it's actually called Captain Tsubasa. So like I reached out to a couple of people and Captain Magic, it's Captain Tsubasa. They're like, so we like dug a little bit into that, like not very much, but that was like one of the things that we did is like how things get
that's
localized.
So interesting. So
it's like it's a language show and it's like we do science, we do culture. It's like, it's a lot of fun and I hope you'll all listen. So those are the two places.
Yeah. Go listen to Radio Lingo and see something. Yeah. if I can pronounce that, and go follow Ahmed's work. It's great and it sounds delicious and now I'm hungry and I gotta go eat
something.
Me
too, actually. I'm very hungry. I'm so hungry right now.
You can follow us at Ethnically Amb on Twitter, Ethnically Ambig, AMBIG on Instagram, and then I'm Shireen, it's Shirohiro on Instagram and Shirohiro666 on Twitter.
And I'm at @AmHostNia on Twitter and @SellingHostNia on Instagram. And you can follow my Substack, sellinghostnia.substack.com, where I'm writing about all sorts of nonsense. Next piece is actually, it might be out by the time this comes out, is my deep, deep and dark fascination with the Michael Imperioli Architectural Digest piece that came out. I'm obsessed. You're going to hear my thoughts about it. What a weirdo. Okay.
Wait, I can't wait for this. Anna's a great writer, so I'm excited. But until then.
And I have sick, sick fascinations with stuff.
When you deep dive, it's a good dive. Know what I mean? Like, it's good. But yeah, that's the episode.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.